We talk about the wisdom and intelligence of the forest in this interview. Suzanne Simard started her career in the forestry industry at a young age, just when clear-cutting for profit was getting popular in Canada. Now a world-leading forest ecologist and professor at the University of British Columbia, Dr. Simard says her life, her relationships, and even her health has been deeply intertwined with her research over the years. Her debut book, Finding the Mother Tree, explores the intimate world of the trees and how they are bound together and what we can learn from that. I began our interview by asking Suzanne what mycorrhizal fungi or fungi is and what its role in connecting trees in the forest to be able to communicate with each other is. Let's take a listen to the interview now.
Mycorrhizal fungi are a certain kind of fungus that all trees associate with all over the world and depend on these certain kinds of fungi, I call them fungi, that actually grow through the soil, pick up nutrients and water, and bring it back to the tree and trade it for photosynthate. So the fungus gets energy from the tree, and in return, the tree gets resources that it absolutely needs to survive, grow, and reproduce. So all trees all over the world are in this obligate mutualistic relationship with the fungus.
How were you able to prove that that exists?
Well, people have known about mycorrhizas for quite a long time, at least for over 100 years. It actually formally recognized them in the late 1880s by a researcher named Franck. But the fact that these fungi can actually, you know, link trees together like an internet was, it was actually first discovered by a scientist in the United Kingdom, David Reed. And he did this work in the laboratory where he grew pine seedlings together in root boxes and colonized them or inoculated them with a single mycorrhizal fungus and saw that they could be linked together. And I wondered if that actually happened in real forests. And so I took that idea, that early study, and investigated it in real forests and saw that, you know, all the trees in even in mixed species forests were connected together by these mycorrhizal fungi, just like an internet, and that they used this network, or this network actually was important in conveying information back and forth between these trees.
The conditions, though, doing that in a forest are a heck of a lot harder than doing it in a lab. You've got climate you can't control. You've got other things like insects and animals that you have to deal with, which I'm sure we'll touch on soon. So why do it in the forest in such a more difficult way than in a lab?
Well, there was a lot of debate after David Reed did a study about whether these things existed in nature, whether or not trees could, you know, be connected below ground, whether they could, you know, share information or resources through this network. And really, like, there was a lot of skepticism. But for me, I wanted to know if this was true, because really in our forests in Canada, you know, we've been clear cutting our forests for a long, since Canada was colonized by Europeans. And more and more trees are being removed from the environment, and the forests are not growing back in the same way, because we planted back our old growth forests with just one or two species, and then actually weeded out, got rid of species like birches and aspens, deciduous trees that we didn't want. And I was seeing that this action, you know, this practice was actually causing the forest to get sick. And so I wanted to investigate, what were we doing wrong? You know, we were kind of disconnecting the forest, and I had grown up knowing it as a connected place. And this study by David Reed suggested to me that indeed that these trees might be connected below ground. And that could be that we were causing it to lose its balance, basically to disconnect this forest. And this could be underlying the sickness that I was seeing. And sure enough, when I looked, there they were. These networks exist throughout the forest and link all the trees together.
The thing that fascinated me a lot, Suzanne, in your book, The Mother Tree, is the fact that you were also able to prove that this exists across species. So not just between birch and birch, or fir and fir, but between birch and fir, and then ultimately also between birch, fir, and pine. I mean, that is fascinating that this occurs across different species.
It does. But you know, if you in communities of forests, in forests, they are multi-species places, right? They're complex places with, you know, that's very rare that we have pure forests of just a single species. That's pretty rare. And then these trees, they grow together for hundreds of years beside each other. They we know that they can complement each other. We know that they can also compete with each other. But the fact is that they are kind of in these, you know, single spots, stuck in one spot, growing beside each other for a long time. And to me, it's not surprising, because they are interacting over, you know, decades and decades, that these linkages would occur between species. And the fact that they, you know, we actually, they share carbon and nitrogen and water through these networks actually helps the community thrive, right? And diverse, thrifty communities we know are, you know, the most productive, they're the healthiest. There's been a lot of studies to show biodiversity is really important to the integrity and resilience of ecosystems. And this connection to me isn't actually that surprising. It would be more surprising if these trees were as isolated as we once thought, right? We once thought that they're just these individuals competing for resources. You know, when you look in a forest, it actually makes more sense that they would be, you know, in these sophisticated relationships with each other.
Suzanne, the other thing that's interesting for me is that you started this work when you were working in the Forest Service, actually, I think, helping them clear forests. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, I started working at an early, you know, I was a young forester. I got a degree in forestry as a forester, and I started working in the forest industry. And that was when, you know, clear cutting was really, you know, getting popular in Canada. It was being used to, you know, basically harvest forests for profit. And so my observations about, you know, about the health of our forests, you know, the state of the diversity of the forests, how, you know, how thrifty they were, really started back when I was working in the industry. And then eventually I did start working for the government, the Forest Service, as a researcher trying to unravel what was wrong, you know, because I was observing that a lot of seedlings that were planted into these clear cuts were actually getting sick and dying. And so, yeah, I was actually a scientist in the government trying to figure that out, and went back during my tenure at the Forest Service to do my PhD to try to figure out, you know, what was going on, what was causing this mortality among the Douglas firs, actually, that were being weeded of their neighbors, you know, and we were seeing this proliferation in disease as a result of the weeding out of birches. And so that's what got me started. It was in service to the government.
How was your initial study and the work that you were doing at the time received by those within government, policymakers, those in forestry service, as you were undertaking this study? What was their response?
My local group of researchers, of course, were, and especially my supervisor, Alan Vise, were, you know, very supportive of me. But the greater Forest Service, you know, where management was happening, policies were being developed, they didn't. I would say the best part of it was that they ignored what I did. That was the, you know, probably the most positive thing I could say. But there were also a segment of them that were, you know, really focused on getting rid of these native plants so that they were not competitive with the trees that they were, you know, had their eye on growing into these great big trees that they could log again in a short order. You know, they were very focused on that collaboration between trees, or that they could be connected, was contravention to their policies. They didn't want to change their policies. And so there was a lot of backlash, actually. And eventually, I mean, I left the Forest Service because it was getting so difficult. And I went into and became a professor, where I was able to expand my research rather than trying to hide it or ignore it or just leave it behind. So, yeah, I would say overall, you know, and the management side, it was, and the policy side, that it was ignored, if not, you know, negatively approached and not accepted.
And you talk about that in the book with particular reference to one person you refer to as the Reverend. Why were people like the Reverend so defensive? Why were they so dismissive of what you were doing?
Well, I mean, there's a long history, right? I don't think we can ascribe blame to any single person. It's, you know, it really started when Darwin was talking about evolution and wrote about it. And, you know, this was also when capitalism was taking hold in Europe and competition became like, you know, such a dominant theory of evolution. And you know, rightfully so, competition is important. But even Darwin knew that collaboration and facilitation was important in plant communities as well. And that didn't get as much credence as this idea that competition led to speciation and natural selection. And of course, this idea of competition was applied very strongly in ecology. In fact, it dominates, you know, a lot of our ecological thinking about how forests are structured and even our practices of how we grow forests, how we grow plantations, how we tend them, how we weed them, for example, is all based on this idea that competition is reigns supreme. And so, you know, so all of these policies, you know, there were so many policies put in place by foresters in this recognition that competition was important, but it got to the extreme where, you know, that was actually, you know, having this negative impact on our forests. But by then, you know, these individual foresters and the policies had become entrenched and whole industries had grown up around it, like the herbicide industry, the spacing and thinning industry, the planting industry. And so there's a lot of money behind it. And so it wasn't just individuals protecting their own policies. There was a whole economy behind it as well. So me, as a young woman who found out something, you know, that was, you know, cool, that was part of this big resistance, is that the world is the economic engine was behind this theory that competition was so important.
And to start to prove your theory, your hypothesis of what you were doing, I think it was you and your sister had to undertake an experiment where you essentially had to poison the trees to try and start getting to the end goal, to the aspiration of what you were studying. So you were essentially poisoning trees to undertake the research. I mean, that must have been something so completely out of line of your philosophy. You talk about your sister having a problem with having to deal to do that as well at the time. What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was so young at the time, but I really wanted to learn about how to decipher what was going on in forests. And unless you're trained as a scientist, which at that time I wasn't, I just had an undergraduate degree. But I got this opportunity to learn about science in forests. But it just so happened that opportunity was tied to this examining this, you know, spraying of herbicides. Because at the time, you know, the forest industry had realized, the thing is they had been clear cutting and not really planting forests back properly. They waited too long. They didn't prepare the sites very well. They planted a lot of trees that were inappropriate for the sites. And so there was a lot of what they called backlog forests where there weren't enough trees growing back. And so they got onto this idea that, oh, it's got to be the shrubs and the herbs, you know, these non-native or these native plants that were the problem. They're the competition. And so there was a huge research program and a whole policy and practices associated with it that was trying to get rid of these native plants. And so I got this opportunity to address this issue, like how well were these practices working? Not that my results made any change. I mean, basically, I did all this research and it was, for the most part, ignored for a long, long time. But that was why I ended up doing that, is because at the time there was a new policy put in place that trees needed to be free to grow or free of these native plants. And in order to get rid of them, they had to develop methods, and Monsanto and these big herbicide companies stepped in and said, oh, you can use our herbicides. And so there we go. We were testing these things, and it was hard to do. It was really hard on my sister, who she was just working for me, and yet she was, you know, we were young and we didn't know, you know, we had a lot of gaps in our knowledge, and we made some mistakes, and, you know, I bear responsibility for that, but, you know, we managed to get through it. We were, you know, we were only in our mid-20s, and we didn't have a lot of expertise out there to help us out, so we made the mistakes and we learned ourselves.
A core part of your research obviously is also focused on what you call the hubs, the elders, but the hubs of the forest, the old trees, the older trees, mm-hmm. which you refer to as the mother trees. Why the use of the term mother trees?
Well, yeah, so, This skepticism about if they existed in forests or in natural ecosystems, I tried to address with a graduate student when I was at the university finally as a professor. I got a graduate student named Kevin Beiler, and we sought to make a map of what this network looked like, just to dispel the, you know, the skepticism, the disbelief. You know, it was essential that we show what it looked like. And so that student, Kevin Beiler, went out into the forest and used DNA techniques. So we looked at the DNA of the individual trees, individual fungi, and then how they were linked together. And what emerged out of that map was that the big old trees were the most highly connected. So they, in graph theory, in neural network theory, these are called hubs. And so they're, and it makes sense from a forest point of view. If you think about it, you know, these big old trees have got huge root systems and they've got the most root tips. And so they're going to have more fungal mycelium that go out and connect with other trees. And they also have huge crowns, like up above, you know, their leaves, their needles are big. And so they have creating a lot of energy through photosynthesis that ends up partly in the roots. And so it drives this energy cycle and the materials or the nutrients and carbon that are moving through the network. And it turns out some of those carbon, nutrients, water are actually transmitted right into seedlings that are growing up around these old trees. So when they shed their seed, you know, these seedlings get established in the forest floor, and then they benefit from linking into these big networks, this internet of the old trees, and they get some of the nutrients from the trees. They also get that benefit from that vast uptake ability of the existing network. And so that nurturing ability of these old trees, of the new growth coming up underneath, led us to calling them mother trees instead of hub trees, which hub is kind of a forgettable term, but mother tree certainly isn't a forgettable term.
You were the first also, you say in the book, you acknowledge the fact actually that the term was used by indigenous populations. I think you mentioned Mary Thomas and some of the indigenous people that you were lucky and fortunate enough to work with. I'm talking specifically about the people like the, I think it's the Sekwepemc people who had acknowledged and talked about the connections. I think Mary Thomas has used the word mother tree as well. And these indigenous philosophies have existed for years, certainly before you studied your research as well. How important was it for you to be able to connect and learn and hear from those people as you were undertaking your research, which I guess also supported what you were looking to do scientifically?
Yeah, you're right. But I was uncovering this stuff long before I actually was able to start working with our indigenous people. I was, you know, a young scientist trying to figure out what was going wrong in our forests. And I, you know, I made these discoveries, and it wasn't until much later, actually only about in the last decade, that I was had the good fortune of working with a number of indigenous people, including my, you know, at the time postdoc, Dr. Teresa Ryan. And I learned that actually these fungal networks, and I was reading about Mary Thomas's work, that these fungal networks have been long known by the first, we call them the First Nations people of Canada, and for thousands of years, and that these connections were absolutely essential to the health of the ecosystems, and that also, you know, it was a really fundamental part of their outlook of how people interact with forests, and that we're all one and linked together. And so to me, it was when I finally got to start working with the Aboriginal people of Canada, I finally felt like, I felt vindicated. And I think that in many ways, they also have felt vindicated in that this marrying together of Western science and long known indigenous science, that we're coming to the same conclusions, and it's making it more accessible to everybody to understand and actually, you know, benefit from this expanded knowledge of how our ecosystems actually work.
Are you and Mary Thomas and people like you the inspiration behind the avatar? Is that where Cameron and others get the whole establishment of the movie Avatar, with the mother tree being the core part of that movie? Is that where this comes from? Is it inspired by your work?
Apparently my work did inspire James Cameron. You know, he never contacted me directly at all. And I only heard that through the grapevine until recently. And I'm actually, you know, James Cameron is making sequels to Avatar. and they're making a documentary film about the science behind Avatar. And so I'm actually, they've invited me to be part of that documentary film in acknowledgement that these networks really did inspire the idea of the home tree and the Navi people and their connections to the home tree. So yeah, I think that it's really cool. I think it's wonderful. And even when I went to see Avatar, you know, when it first came out, I was so thrilled to see these ideas, you know, embedded in this movie that everybody could see and appreciate.
Suzanne, you also, I think you use the term mother tree for the first time in the book at a time in your life where work was hard. You were distanced from your family and your husband at the time, Don, and your children, Hannah, and I think it's Nava, who were living in a different mm-hmm. part of the country at the time, and you had to travel weekends to be back with them. Is that why you particularly use the word mother tree or the term mother tree at the time? Because of, is it an allegory for your life and what you were doing while you were studying?
Well, you know, certainly the things that were happening in my life at the time and all through this journey informed what I was doing, right? Like my, you know, separation from my family in that very difficult period of time, you know, I did want to understand better, you know, why, you know, I was losing my connections with my own children because of this, you know, this very unfortunate situation. And it was heartbreaking. And I think that that led me to look deeper at connections in nature, to understand my own, you know, literally grief about being separated from my little girls. And then seeing this in the forest, it actually helped me understand, you know, the fundamental reason for connection, you know, among people, among trees. We're all kind of built the same way, you know, like we are about our relationships. We have to nurture them and look after each other. And so certainly, you know, as I was discovering these ideas of connection and these mother trees, I was going through like this trauma myself. And I think it helped me heal. And it also helped propel my work forward. And the questions I asked next, which are, do these mother trees actually nurture their own kin? Like, is there kin recognition in trees, which we discovered that indeed there is. And so I would never have asked that question if I hadn't been through this separation myself. So yeah, for sure, these things went together.
And also you research further into not only looking after their kin, but particularly if trees were dying or becoming sick, whether or not they could communicate with other trees through mycorrhizal fungi, as you call it, to be able to build and have them build resilience in and amongst themselves. So they were essentially, as they were in a dying state, feeding other trees to protect them, which again is a little bit of an allegory for what you were doing with your life at the time, particularly as you were afflicted by cancer, I think, at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. I think all the stress of being separated from my kids and, you know, other things as well. But I think that was the primary reason I got sick and I got cancer. And I started digging really deeply into, you know, what if I'm dying, which I, you know, I was, you know, it was serious, and I still have lots of risks, but what do I do if I'm dying? What do I do to help my kids? Like, what can I learn? And what can I learn from the trees of what I can do? And so I started doing research on dying trees, like what happens. And dying is a process, right? I think we forget that with trees and forests, but you know, forests are dynamic places, and there's always death and birth going on. And I was going through this too, and so I thought, what information is going on passing between the mothers in these forests and their seedlings? Is there parallels? Are there parallels? And I found that, you know, as these old trees were dying, that they were actually sharing a lot of their energy, their carbon, directly with the seedlings around them. And also they were sending defense messages. So actual, you know, biochemical communication that these seedlings would then receive this information and actually upregulate their own genetic machinery and produce more defense enzymes to protect themselves. And, you know, I would never have done that if I hadn't been through all of this myself. And even, you know, you know, multiple experiments later, we now know, you know, that yeah, for sure, these old trees, as they're stressed and passing on, that they are really, you know, putting forward a lot of information, their legacy, their experiences through climate change and any stresses they've been, that's encoded in their genes, is actually being transmitted to these next generations of seedlings.
Is that what finding Mother Tree is ultimately about? The ability, I mean, you make reference within the book about the trees reflecting, I think, communities. Perhaps they shared water to keep their community whole, replenishing their companions through times of hardship. We can find this in ourselves and what we do alone, but also in the way that we enact together our own roots and systems interlace, entangle, grow into and away from each other and back again in a million subtle moments. Is that what finding Mother Tree is ultimately about? The reflection of human society, or our ability to reflect ourselves in the way that forests also live, cohabitate, and work together as a community?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's about learning about ourselves, right? And for me, learning about myself and learning about these trees and trying to find a better way. And, you know, we are going through environmental crises, and we, you know, a lot of it is our own, it is our own doing. And we've made mistakes, and I've made mistakes, and we, you know, we need to learn from this. We can learn from these trees about that we need this connection. We need these healthy relationships. We depend on them. We're not out there on our own. We're all in this together. And there are so many ways to do better, right? There's so many ways to heal ourselves and heal the environment. And actually, one of the things I learned is that we are wired for healing, right? That forests and people and societies, through our relationships, we want to heal all the time. That's the force. And I learned that in myself, you know, and I think that's, you know, that's partly why I was able to recover is I was able to learn I was built to heal. And I also reached out to my family and my friends, and they all helped me. And I think that, you know, as we go forward and try to heal our forests, we need to remember that, you know, keeping these old trees around, just like keeping our elders around, is absolutely essential to, you know, as a scaffolding for the future, that we need their experiences, their genes, their legacies. We, you know, that's essential to this healing process. And so, you know, it is a journey. It was a journey for me. It's a journey for the human race to figure out how to get through, you know, our existential crises of climate change and biodiversity loss and even our social migrations. I mean, we need to learn from these the past mistakes, and there are ways forward, and we just have to dig deeper, look deeper, and all the learning is right there. The way forward is right in front of us.
And also the need for diversity, Suzanne? The way in which foreign species are also brought into the community and are engaged through, as you have proven, mycorrhizal fungi, that they are also brought into the community and looked after within that community as well. Is that also a key part of the message of finding Mother Tree?
It is, yes. Diversity, in ecology we call it biodiversity, but even in our own human communities, diversity matters, right? So certainly what I found is that these linkages, they happen not just within species, but between species, you know, between tree species, between understory species, everything is linked together. We're all one together, you know, and that diversity, you know, having different species of trees and animals and plants actually helps the ecosystem thrive. And there's been lots and lots of studies looking at different aspects of ecosystems to show that the more biodiversity you have, the healthier, the more resilient these ecosystems are. And it's just, you know, if you even think in our own human communities, we have diversity, and our systems thrive on that, right? We need people to do different things, see things in different ways to create a fuller, healthier community. It's the same thing in forests.
And you also say, quote, ecosystems are so similar to human societies. They're built on relationships. The stronger these are, the more resilient the system. I wondered how much of a reflection that was also with relation to the relationship you had with your brother and the argument that ensued before your brother's passing, and you were unable to mend that relationship before your brother's unfortunate passing. I wondered how much of an effect that had on you and on your study, and whether that's also reflected throughout finding Mother Tree.
I mean, it was absolutely devastating, right? Like, my brother and I were so close when we were kids and did everything together. And then, you know, kids fight and sibling rivalry, everybody does it. And it was an unfortunate thing that, you know, I was in that sort of having this conflict with him. You know, and really, you look back and it's so silly, right? We all have these silly arguments and we think they're so important at the time. And then, you know, unfortunately, you know, in the middle of all that, my brother died, and I just felt it was devastating. But of course, you know, I needed to heal myself after that. I need to understand what healing was all about. And healing is about having healthy relationships. And it's the same thing in Forrest. Like, Forrest can't heal from whatever tragedies or devastation is wrought upon them without having their neighbors and a diversity of plants and bacteria and fungi all there together, working together to create a healthier environment. And so, yeah, I mean, of course, my experience as a person and all I'd been through, of course, it shaped my science. And I think that's a really important message is too, that science is such a human thing, right? Like, we ask questions that we think are important based on what we know about things, but our experiences. And it's, you know, we kind of pretend that science is this objective, you know, we're the objective observer, but really we're embedded in it. We're people, we're doing this work. And our questions that we ask is from who we are. And I really, in my book, I wanted to bring that forward, to dispel the myth that science was some weird thing that you can't trust. It is about us, right? And how we do things and see the world and make sense of our world. And so, of course, you know, my science was deeply informed by my human experience.
We were hoping to talk to you earlier this week, but you were actually in the field, working in the forest doing work. So we really appreciate the fact that you're available now. There are some dangers in doing this work in the forest, particularly in Canada and North America. I mean, in New Zealand, it's a pretty safe place aside from weather. You know, we have weta and other indigenous species, which aren't that dangerous. But in Canada and North America, you have to deal with things like black bears and grizzly bears. And I note in particular a reference to an incident you had with a friend with a grizzly mama and two cubs, where the grizzly mama basically kept you in detention. I mean, that must be a fairly dangerous thing to have to deal with when you're studying in forests in that part of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very different doing science in a forest than in a laboratory, right? Like, in Canada, we have cougars, we have grizzly bears. You know, there's lots of dangers and mosquitoes. Like, it's not easy to be out there doing this work with these great big organisms with predators around and, you know, over long time frames. I mean, I'm literally following experiments that are now 35 years old, and I'm going to continue to follow them as long as I'm alive. And so, yeah, it's challenging. And then, of course, dealing with grizzly bears is part of it. And so you just got to be on your toes.
Wasn't your mother almost mauled by a bear when she was a child?
Yeah, well, on my mom's side of the family, well, both sides of my family, they were settlers, and of course, being settlers meant clearing land, and clearing land meant clearing forests in Canada. You know, so there's bears all around, and so yeah, there was a time on the Ferguson Ranch at Edgewood, they also grew apples and chickens and pigs. It was self-sufficient, and there were bears around, and so there was a bear that was coming to get some apples, and my great-grandfather shot the bear as my mom was just on the porch. So that would have been in like the 1940s, I guess.
Wow. And there's also an incident, isn't there, where you're studying, I think, salmon going from a water body into the forest, and you were examining this really closely, and you had, I think, your Indigenous colleague working with you, who essentially said you guys are crazy and turned around and went back to the boat, didn't they?
Yes, that's right. We were doing a study on the west coast of British Columbia in a territory, the Haltsik territory. Haltsik are one of the nations, the Midcoast nations, and they have a very intimate relationship with salmon and forests, and you know, it's their livelihood is dependent on salmon and western red cedar trees, and bears carry spawning salmon from the rivers into the forest and eat the salmon underneath these old trees. And they leave a lot of the flesh behind, and it decays and ends up in the root system and inside the trees. So there's salmon nitrogen right inside these trees. And so we wanted to, you know, we were investigating this, and we wanted to know like how the salmon affected the mycorrhizal networks and how the salmon nitrogen might move through the forest through these networks. And so, of course, that meant going into the forest and finding, you know, where the salmon bones in the forest. And so we were out hunting for salmon bones and crawling through these, you know, these salmonberry bushes that actually are called salmonberry bushes, and following bear trails to find out, you know, and basically where they would take their fish and where the bones were. So yeah, we were right in there. I mean, we didn't run into a grizzly bear, luckily, but they were certainly, that was their habitat, and they were all around. We just were lucky at that day, I think.
Better you than me, Suzanne. Were you working on the Mother Tree project this week when we were hoping to speak with you? Were you right in the middle of it, were you?
Well, I am. I'm constantly working on the Mother Tree project, but yesterday I was actually up in a another forest near my grandparents' home in the Cusp. It's a little tiny town in the Kootenay area, which is west of the Rockies in Canada. And yeah, there's a lot of logging, clear-cut logging going on, and there was the community watershed is planned for logging, and part of it is to, you know, is to make money, but also to reduce fire risk of the little communities, because we have way more fire going through our forest now because of climate change. And so there's a lot of anxiety about how to protect communities, but there's a lot of shenanigans going on too. And so sometimes, you know, these forests are logged for money rather than protection. And so there was a community group that were worried about their old growth forests and asked me to come and take a look. And sure enough, it's very politically complicated, and people's emotions are high. And of course, the forests are at risk, and I'm trying to help out. And it's not just in the Cusp, but there are other places in British Columbia. Right now, there's a huge protest going on the West Coast at a place called Fairy Creek, one of the last old growth watersheds left on Vancouver Island. Like, there's only 3% of these old growth forests left. They've all been clear cut. And people are basically, you know, sitting up in trees, protesting. There are hunger strikes going on. There are police. There's been 55 arrests of protesters. It's just, you know, people are emotional. They're upset that our forests are getting logged as quickly as they are, that there's very little left. And yeah, this is going to go on until, you know, there's some reasonable solutions brought to bear on the problem.
And is this clear cutting being done for all intents and purposes for the sake of money and revenue under the veil of fire safety?
Yeah, I think a lot of there's both are going on. You know, certainly some of these, I call them treatments, fire safety treatments, are legitimate. I know in my own town of Nelson that they've done a really good job of like clearing out the understory. But there's other cases where people get greedy and they'll take out the old growth forest as well to make money on the side, or the companies will. And that's where, you know, we really need eyes on the ground to stop that. You know, it's, I don't know, there's just some human nature aspects that aren't always up to snuff, and we need to keep our eye out for that.
Suzanne, the Mother Tree Project, developing an emergent philosophy, complexity science. What is that?
Well, complexity science is really about understanding systems. So, you know, ecosystems are a system. Social systems are another system. Even our transportation systems are systems. They have certain designs. They have certain properties. You know, in Western science, we've tended to deconstruct things. We've reduced them down to the parts to understand how they work. But in doing that reductionist work, we miss a lot, right? We make big mistakes, like ignoring collaboration in forests. by so focusing on the one thing, competition. And so the unraveling of ecosystems as a result of that poor knowledge of systems is serious. It's important that we get a grip on this. And so there's emerged from this science called complexity science about understanding how systems work. And what it basically shows is that relationships, just like we've been talking about, are really important, like relationships between all the parts of the systems, in ecosystems that would be, you know, the plants, the trees, the bugs, the fungi, the soil, the air, all of it working together to create these emergent properties of ecosystems that we don't completely understand from putting all the parts back together. So those emergent properties being like the ability of forests to create clean water and clean oxygen and store carbon and be diverse and thrifty. Those are emergent properties that we just can't, you know, we've proven to ourselves through so many mistakes that we can't, through reductionist science, put these systems back together again. There's more to them than meets the eye. And so this whole science has emerged to try to understand better about how these systems actually work, how they function, and then we can do a better job of managing them.
Suzanne, I wish you all the best for the project, the Mother Tree Project, and for the book. And also the best of health to you as well. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
That was Suzanne Simard discussing her new book, Finding Mother Tree.